Hello, and welcome to the Service Contractors Business Tape of the Month. This monthly cassette tape series represents yet another step in accomplishing Grandy & Associates' vision of helping the service contractor come to a place of maturity and profitability. Each month, a different national speaker from throughout the service and trades industry will share dozens of cost-reducing, profit-increasing ideas to help you become a more profitable company. This month's tape is presented by Gary Shine. Gary is president of the small business consulting firm of Merfeld & Shine Incorporated of Boston, Massachusetts and Providence, Rhode Island, which specializes in business plan development, venture financing, marketing, and business brokerage. He was recently cited as the Outstanding Consultant of the Year by the Small Business Development Center. His office and home are in Providence. He is also an assistant professor at a local university where he was instrumental in the development of the school's entrepreneurship program. Gary is author of three books entitled How to Avoid 101 Small Business Mistakes, Myths, and Misconceptions, How to Sell Your Business for More Money, and How You Can Buy a Business Without Overpaying. He holds an MBA and MA in Communications and Education. Today, Gary will share with us some of the common mistakes, myths, and misconceptions that small businesses often make. Listen closely, and perhaps you can avoid some of these traps in your company.
When starting in business, people get a lot of advice from a lot of people. One piece of advice that seems to come through over and over again is learn from your mistakes. You're not going to do everything right the first time. You will make mistakes. Learn from those mistakes, and you'll be better off for it, and your business will be better off for it. I've given a lot of advice as a consultant, and something occurred to me that day in and day out, I was seeing a lot of the same mistakes being made over and over again. So the thought I had was, well, what if I could put together these mistakes, put them in the form of a book and in the form of a tape, and save other people from making mistakes? In other words, what if you could learn not from your own mistakes, but from the mistakes of other people? That's what I did, and that's what this tape is going to be about the mistakes that I've seen made over and over again, and hopefully by learning from the mistakes that others have made before you, you could avoid the same mistakes in the future. Let's talk about some of the mistakes people make in managing their money in the finances of a business. Let me start with a warning, though. Clearly, money's at the root of any business. I mean, there's no question about it. You need money to operate. Money is going to be a problem at the beginning, and in all likelihood, if not a problem every day, is going to be a problem at least several times throughout the course of your business. I'm going to talk about some of the more common mistakes that I see people making in terms of managing money in their business, but I want to start with a mistake that is really quite the opposite of that. And that's that a lot of business owners assume that all their problems have to do with money. In a lot of cases, money isn't really the problem, although it is blamed whether it is or not. Something I do with clients to smoke out whether money really is the problem is ask, well, if you had more money, what would you do with it? If the answer is pay off old bills, that means that there's an underlying problem that probably doesn't have to do with money. It has to do with marketing. It has to do with management. It has to do with something else. If people are thinking about using the money for growth, well, that makes more sense to me. So while money is essential to operating a business, don't make the mistake of thinking that if you had piles of money, if you had 2-3 times as much money as you do to work with, that everything is going to magically fall into place, because it's not. In fact, a lot of people think that it's good to start a business on a shoestring because it teaches somebody to operate without having piles of money to work with and lots of money to throw at problems that really have nothing to do with money. It's very easy to spend money, but it's not so easy to spend money that you don't have, and a lot of people think that's good training. So don't assume that all your business problems have to do with the lack of money. One very dangerous problem that I see dealing with the management, the use of money in a small business, has to do with taxes. It has to do specifically with failure to pay withholding taxes when they're due. Let me explain. the IRS, the Internal Revenue Service, has the responsibility of collecting taxes from virtually everybody who works in the United States. You, as a business owner, has the responsibility to withhold those taxes and to pay it into the government on behalf of your employees. So if you're running a business with employees, and even if there's only one employee on the payroll and that employee is you, you are responsible for paying money into the government. You are responsible for doing so on time. You are responsible, of course, from withholding those taxes from your pay and from the pay of anybody who is in your employ. Now, here's the problem that I see that comes in much too often. You're responsible on a certain date, and I don't want to give specifics, talk to your accountant as far as the specifics as to when you're responsible to pay in money. But what I do want to address is what happens when you don't pay it in on time. Let's say your withholding taxes are due, as mine usually are, on the 15th of every month. Come the 16th of the month, if your taxes aren't paid, you're delinquent. And the thing is, the IRS isn't going to come to you that day. In fact, they're probably not going to come to you if you're a week late, a month late. Probably you could go several months before they come to you and say, hey, where's our money? Problem is, a lot of small business owners who are strapped for cash get lulled into complacency and figure, hey, wait a minute here. I'm late, and I know I'm late, and nothing happened, and I'm still late, and nothing's happening. Maybe I can get away with this. And the bill that may have been $1,000 one month becomes $2,000, becomes $3,000, and so on and so on. Then it collects interest. Then it collects penalties, which are very severe, by the way. Before you know it, it could be an awful lot of money. And mark my words, sooner or later, the IRS will catch up with you. And when they do, they have resources at their disposal to make you and I pay that other creditors just don't have. As a matter of fact, the IRS bill is probably the last one to leave unpaid. Not only can they charge you interest, not only can they charge you penalties, 5%, 10%, or more, but they can go beyond the corporation. If you're a corporation and think, well, that's okay, they can't collect it from me personally, that may work for other creditors, but it's not going to work for the IRS. The IRS will collect the money from your company, from you, in any way they can, and they won't hesitate to do it. And don't be fooled into thinking just because they don't do it on the day it's due, a week after it's due, a month, or in some cases as much of a year after it's due, don't make the mistake of thinking that they're not going to collect, because they will collect, and they will easily, in the process of collecting, if necessary, close you down, and much more than that. Don't be delinquent in paying your taxes to the IRS. When I first saw this mistake, I was baffled by it. What I'm talking about is people borrowing money personally, taking that money, putting it into their company, and then with that money that started out being theirs, they pay themselves a salary. In other words, they'll borrow $1,000, put that $1,000 into the company, and then write themselves a salary check, say, of $1,000. What's wrong with doing that? Well, it doesn't really accomplish anything, number one, but worse, when you do that, when you take what's essentially your money and pay yourself a salary with your money, you also have to pay Uncle Sam. You have to pay the IRS in taxes on that money, in income taxes, in other words. You have to pay Social Security taxes. You might have to pay state income taxes, state unemployment taxes, and so forth, all with money that started out being yours. It doesn't make any sense. Now, don't get me wrong. There's certainly nothing wrong with borrowing money to start a business and borrowing money to pay a lot of expenses that are necessary to running a business. But if you need to borrow money to make ends meet, just borrow the money and use it personally and then pay it back. Don't put it through your books and take it out as salary because you're paying taxes that are completely unnecessary. Why people do this, I'm still not sure. The only thing I could come up with is it makes them feel like the business is going well, they're earning a salary, where in reality they're just borrowing money, not only paying interest on that money, but paying unnecessary taxes and other expenses on that money. So don't borrow money to pay yourself a salary. The next mistake that I want to address is spending money on a business prematurely. A lot of people, especially, although not entirely, but especially young businesses, perhaps startups, the entrepreneur decides, well, I'm going to start a business now. I'm going to need to buy, better have a new truck and better get a new set of tools and better get some tools that I'm not going to need that often, maybe even if I only need them once a month. Hey, this is a business now. I got to have them. And I better hire an employee because pretty soon I'm going to have so much business I'm not going to be able to handle it myself. And before you know it, they're spending money left and right before there's any proof, any good indication that the business is going to work out. My own philosophy on small business ventures has always been to spend as little money as possible until there's good indication of success. Once the business looks like it's going to survive, once it looks like it's going to take off and do well, spending money to grow the business becomes more justified. You know, several years ago, a former student came back to me and he said that he learned something about small businesses. And what he learned was that the perfect small business is a post office box to which people send money. What did he mean by that? What he meant is that businesses shouldn't take on overhead, shouldn't take on expenses until and unless it's proven that they're needed. If you could make the same amount of money without the new truck, well, then go ahead and do it. If you could make the same amount of money without buying the new tools, what do you need the new tools for? Same can be said for the computer system. Same could be said for the employee, the secretary, the new office facilities, whatever it is. Unless it's justified from a financial point of view, why get involved in it? What I'm saying is that before you spend money, sit down with yourself, be as honest as you can with yourself and say, do I really need this as a business expense, or is it something that I just want to have even though I don't really need it? If the answer is you absolutely need it, if it's absolutely going to help you to run your business better, in other words, to make more money, by all means, it's a great investment. But if in your heart of hearts the expense just is not justified in terms of running your business, then don't spend it. Don't spend money on a business that's not economically justified. The next mistake that I see is what I call protecting sacred cow expenses. In the Hindu religion, cows are considered sacred in that no harm is allowed to come of them. It's obviously very differently than we think of cows in this country, but they think of cows as sacred. So what I see in a lot of small businesses is that people assume that there's certain expenses that you just have to take on, and they're different depending on who's running the business. In some cases, the business owner assumes, well, we just have to have expensive stationery, you know, otherwise it's not really a business. Other cases, well, we have to own our own equipment. We can't rent equipment. I don't care how seldom we need it. We have to have this piece of equipment or that tool and so forth. Or we have to have a fancy car or a fancy truck, or we have to keep running this ad, never mind whether it's producing revenue or not. We have to keep doing it. Why? Well, the same reason as the sacred cow principle. In other words, there is no good reason for it. It's just the way that the business owner says it is. What I said just a minute ago about justifying all overhead plays here too. It's very important that all your overhead, that all your expenses, in fact, be justified. Don't assume that you need expensive stationery, that you need new trucks, that you need this, that, or the other thing. What I said before about the perfect small business is the post office box to which people send money is true here too. Only get involved in spending money on things that you need. Don't go into your business with the assumption that you need to have this, that, and the other thing that costs money. Let me talk for a minute about dealing with bankers. Entrepreneurs, when starting businesses, even when the business has been going for a while, bankers are feared. Small business owners are often afraid of their bankers. The bank, in a way, encourages that. When you walk into the bank, you don't see somebody working out of their home. You're likely to see marble columns, and you're likely to see executives in three-piece suits sitting behind big desks. Part of the reason for that is, well, let's face it, it's to make you a little bit intimidated in dealing with them, making the bank look more powerful than they may be. Let me tell you a little story that I heard from a client of mine a while ago. He went into the bank. He was applying for a business loan. And the usual, he was given folders full of papers to fill out in triplicate and so forth and so forth. And he brought it into the loan officer, and the loan officer looks through it and then closes the door to his office. And he says, you know, I envy guys like you. In a way, I wish I could be one of you. I wish I could start a small business. You know, you guys go out there and you take the risks and you do what needs to be done. And me, I sit here in this office and I shuffle paper all day. But really, I probably never will go out on my own. I'm probably going to always be with the bank, and I really envy guys like you. Well, that kind of turned around his thinking. He had always assumed that the bankers had it all figured out, and us lowly entrepreneurs, well, we're just at their mercy. Really, we're not. The banker, in evaluating a business loan, what are they concerned with? They're concerned with getting their money back, pure and simple. They don't take big risks. They take very, very small risks. And the risk is that they're going to get paid back, and they have to be relatively assured or very assured that they're going to get it back. And if they are, you'll get the loan, and if they're not, you won't. Of course, it's complicated a little bit by the fact, and keep this in mind, that bankers, that banks are highly regulated, that the federal government particularly tells them a lot what they could do and what they can't do. So that complicates matters further, and a lot of times they might want to do something, but they're prohibited to do it for any of a variety of rules. If you can prove to the bank that they're going to get paid back by showing them that there's adequate security, adequate collateral behind the loan, in other words, a house or stocks or bonds or other things that the bank could, let's call a spade, that a bank can take away from you if need be, if you could show them that the business is or is going to generate the kind of cash flow that is necessary to paying off that loan or to making the payments on that loan over time, then you're a good candidate for a loan. Otherwise, quite frankly, you're not. That's the way bankers think. That's the way bankers are forced to think. However, there are different banks in town. There is competition among banks. A lot of entrepreneurs think, well, there's something prohibiting them from going from one bank to another. Not at all. The same reason your customers can, if you're a plumber, can go to another plumber and another plumber and get three different quotes. You can do the same thing with banks. You can go to the first bank. If you don't like what they're telling you, nothing's to stop you from going to the bank next door, the bank across the street, and so forth, and see what they have to offer. Don't be afraid of bankers. They provide a service, in a lot of cases a necessary service. Go in there with confidence, and equally as importantly, go in there proving to them that they are going to get their money back and you should be in much better shape. A lot of small business owners, including a lot of service contractors, are very hesitant to accept credit cards. I hear things like, well, they take 3%, 4%, 5%. It's a hassle to accept credit cards. It's not only do they take the percentage, they charge me a certain amount every year. Who needs it? Well, there's another side to it, another way of looking at it. First of all, yeah, they do charge 3 or 4 or 5%. However, you get something back for your money. What you get is, once you accept that credit card, you have, essentially, you have cash. It doesn't look like cash, but essentially it's deposited into your account as cash. As long as you follow the rules of MasterCard and Visa and the others, you are going to get paid on it. Whether that customer pays the bank or not really isn't your problem, as long as you have appropriate authorization, which is very easy to get. Once you have that, that money is good money, and if the bank doesn't collect on it, that's between the bank and the customer, has nothing to do with you. You will get your money. There's another good reason to accept credit cards, and that is it's shown time and time again when people study it that when a customer can pay with a credit card, not only are they more likely to buy, they're also more likely to choose the more expensive item or the more expensive service when they're given a choice. In other words, let's say you're a plumber and somebody needs a new hot water heater. And let's say you have one that installed would be $400 and another one that would be $600 installed. If you can accept a credit card, that customer is much more likely to go with the $600 model, the more expensive one, merely because they can pay with a credit card and worry about it at the end of the month or something. So because the money is as good as cash, because it's a tremendous convenience for customers, and because the customer is, frankly, more likely to spend more money on your product and service, you're well advised to consider accepting credit cards. A lot of service contractors try to work without granting credit. Pay me cash or pay me by check, but pay me now is the kind of thing that I hear, as far as I'm concerned, too often. In a lot of cases, it's a good idea to take the risk and grant credit. Let people pay you in 30 days or some period of time. And I hear you saying, well, but then some of them aren't going to pay me and I have to go chasing my money. Yeah, that's true. But nevertheless, in the long run, you're going to be better off if you do judiciously extend credit. Let me give you an example. Suppose that you or I were hired by a big company and your new job title is you're the credit manager for Mega Incorporated. And Mega Incorporated, last year they granted $100 million in credit sales and 3.5% of that money was uncollected, ended up as bad debt. So $3.5 million was unpaid. And suppose they're paying you, let's pick a number, $35,000 a year, and you go in there and you tighten things up such that you cut the bad debt rate in half. The next year, you know, your boss calls you in and says, well, you know, what have you done for my company? You've been here for a year. We paid you $35,000. Ah, boss, what I did, it's unbelievable. We used to have a 3.5% bad debt rate. Now we have half that much, 1.75% debt rate. I saved this company many times my salary. Is he going to say congratulations? Probably not. Probably he's going to say you're fired. Why? I mean, you just saved this company about $1.5 million. Well, because what he knows, and that you apparently didn't know in tightening the credit too much, is that you threw out a lot of the good with the bad. By making the credit terms too tight, you screened out a lot of deadbeats, to be sure. You also screened out a lot of people who said, hey, if you're not going to give me credit, I'll go elsewhere. People who would have paid their bills right on time. The boss figures it's worth it to let take a little bad debt. It's worth it to let a couple deadbeats slip through if, as a result, we save a lot of paying customers that are going to come back to us again and again and again and pay their bills on time. So I'm not saying that you won't have bad debt. You will have bad debt. But you have to make judgments, and you have to, not have to, but I advise you in a lot of cases to consider extending credit and to accept as a fact of life that you will have some deadbeats, you will have some bad debt, but you'll get paid for it several times over by gaining new customers that you'd otherwise lose if you don't grant credit. It's a mistake to evaluate your success in business based on total sales volume, based on gross sales volume. It makes more sense to look at total income to yourself in the form of profit or whatever form that income is taken than it does to look at total sales volume. Consider for a minute that you have two options, two choices. You could own business A or business B. Business A, it has 25 employees, say, it has gross sales of $1.5 million. It has big offices, and when all said and done, the owner is earning a total of $40,000 a year. Business B is a lot different. Business B has one full-time employee, that of course is the owner, one half-time helper. The business is grossing a mere $80,000 a year, but when all said and done, the owner of that business is making $48,000. Now, which would you rather have? Business A, $1.5 million in sales, but $40,000 is left over at the end for you? Or business B, $80,000 in sales, but $48,000 is left over for you? Logically, the answer is easy, B. A lot of entrepreneurs in their heart of hearts would rather have business A. Why? For ego reasons. You got nice offices, you've got all these employees running around. Never mind the fact that you're making only 80% as much money as the owner of business B. Business B probably works out of his house, answers his own phone, and doesn't get all the perks in ego terms of the owner of business A, where it looks like it's a good substantial business. But nevertheless, he's laughing all the way to the bank with that extra $8,000. my point is this. It's very simple. Don't look at your gross sales figures as much as you look at your net profit figures or your total income figure, income that flows to you. That's the important thing, not the gross sales. Let's talk for a few minutes about some general management kinds of mistakes that I see over and over again. The first one that I want to talk about is what I call experts with magic answers. It's kind of a myth that a lot of small business people like to live by, that there's experts out there who have magic answers, who by either saying the right thing or by waving their magic wand or something can straighten out their whole business and make everything work out well and everyone will live happily ever after. It doesn't quite work that way. Fortunately or unfortunately, what you have to come to terms with is that if you run a small business, you run that small business. It's easy for me or for someone else to sit there in office and say, you should try this or you should try that or this is what you need to do. It's easy to say that. It's quite another thing to have to carry that out. There are people who know certain things about business, to be sure. There's experts in marketing and there's experts in finance and there's experts in accounting and many other aspects of running a business. But the point that I'm trying to make is, despite the degrees that somebody else has, despite the MBAs, the whatever the degree is that they happen to have, does not mean that they know more about your business overall than you do. Yes, an accountant knows more about accounting. Yes, a marketing person might have some tricks in marketing, but in putting it all together, you're the guy, you're the person who has to take overall responsibility for running that business. You're the one who has to run it on a day-to-day basis. You're the one who has to accept or reject what these experts are telling you. Take it for what it's worth, put it together, use it, or at your option, don't use it, but accept the fact that you're the one who's in overall charge of your business. Let me talk about the mistake of using, or I should really say, of overusing lawyers. There's no question about it that lawyers are absolutely necessary to any small business on an occasional basis. If you have a major contract that you're working on, absolutely your lawyer should at the very least take a look at it. If somebody's suing you, if somebody's even threatening to sue you, your lawyer should absolutely be consulted. However, what I don't approve of is small business owners running to their lawyer for things that have nothing to do with the law. A lot of small business owners turn to their lawyer and figure, hey, well, this guy knows all about the law. He must also know about accounting, and he must know about finance, and he must know about marketing and sales, and I'm going to ask him for advice. Doesn't make any sense at all to be paying someone, what, $70, $100, $150, $200 an hour for something that they're not trained in. Why would you pay a lawyer, say, $150 an hour to give you advice on general management when he might know less than you do about it? It just doesn't make sense. Another problem I see with lawyers is this assumption that you can't negotiate fees. You know, the lawyer sits there in his suit at his desk and says, yes, I charge $180 an hour, and kind of makes you feel a little silly for even asking. I mean, you know, why would you be concerned with that? Well, the reason to be concerned with that is because the lawyer down the street might be just as good or better and charge $110 or $100 or $90 an hour or something less. Don't be afraid to talk to your lawyer in advance, preferably, about fees. Don't be afraid to shop among two or three or four lawyers to get the best deal in terms of fees, but also in terms of the way that you work together, your comfort level, and so forth. When choosing a lawyer, make sure that you choose one that has some small business experience. You may have a lawyer, I see this happen a lot when people are starting a business. Well, you know, there's this lawyer here, and he did a very nice job with my parents' will, or I had a workers' comp case a couple of years ago, got me a terrific settlement. That's all well and good, but unless that guy has small business experience, he's probably not the lawyer for you. Go to somebody with small business experience. In fact, if you're a plumber or an electrician, preferably go to someone who has experience working with plumbers or electricians, but at the very least, go to someone who has some experience with small business, and don't overuse your lawyer. It's a mistake to keep less than adequate records. A small business, like it or not, has to have good records for a couple reasons. Entrepreneurs are, as a rule, not known as the world's best record keepers. But two reasons right off the bat to keep good records. First, they're demanded by taxing authorities. If you're ever audited, hopefully you won't be, but you might be, if you're audited, the IRS agent is going to want to see a lot of pieces of paper. You know those pieces of papers that you stuffed in your jacket pocket and then put into a shoebox and then lost, thinking, you know, who cares about any of this? Well, that IRS agent is going to care about that very much. So you're going to have to have them. You're going to have details for that day that hopefully will never come but may when you're audited. Even besides that, for your own purposes, it's nice to have good records. It's you don't always know what you're going to call upon those records to do for your own purposes besides taxes. In other words, you might want to look back in a few years and say, gee, it seems that I had a lot of customers who lived in this part of town, or it seems that a lot of customers were asking for this kind of, let's say, alarm system that has a high profit margin. I want to take a look at that. I want to go back into my records. Or I want to look at, I was running this ad in whatever, the Yellow Pages. Let's see how many people called me and said that they called me from the Yellow Pages so I could analyze it and decide on what I'm going to do in terms of advertising there in the future. It's nice to have the records for that. It's absolutely essential that you have them for the IRS, for state taxing authorities. At the same time, I understand I'm not the world's greatest record keeper. I hate doing it. Most entrepreneurs hate doing it, but it's something that you have to discipline yourself to do and to do a good job of. Another mistake, changing terms midstream. I see a lot of people in business, including a lot of service contractors, changing terms midway through a job. Most business people subscribe to a kind of an unwritten law of ethics that once a deal is made and agreed to, it's made, it's done, it's too late to change it, and you have to live by it. However, I see some people, especially inexperienced people, changing terms midstream. It makes a lot of sense. Gee, you know, Mr. Customer, I told you that to put this duct in was going to cost $1,500. I forgot to consider this and this, and, you know, it's taking us longer than it should, and it's really going to cost $1,900. Is that okay? It's not okay. Even if the customer says it's okay, it's still not okay because you're going to generate bad will. You're probably not going to work for that customer again because the customer is going to reason, oh, geez, you know, he tells you one price and then he charges another. You don't need that. The customer certainly doesn't want that. Don't do it. Once you make an agreement, live by it. Which actually brings up another warning. Don't give customers price quotes off the top of your head. You're going to be pressured all the time. A customer is going to say something like, well, tell me about what it'll cost. I know you have to go back to your office and figure it in detail, but what do you think? Off the top of your head, what do you think? The temptation is to say, well, I think $1,000, I think whatever, $1,500. Try to avoid doing that because even if you warn the customer that, well, I really have to figure it and I don't know until I get back to the office, but I think about this much, the amount that you give the customer is still going to stick in his head. And if you come back with a different quote, which in all likelihood you will, it's going to look to him like you're changing something, even though you are not. So the best way to avoid it is to try to discipline yourself not to give off the cuff, off the top of your head, price quotes. Now, it's perfectly acceptable to add to a bill or to tell a customer you're going to have to add to a bill if the customer changes something. If the customer says, well, you know what I told you before that we only need one radiator in this room, really we need two. Or, you know, when I said I don't want this window alarmed, well, you know, I changed my mind, we do want it alarmed. No problem. You have every right, and in fact, I would advise you to get out your book and tell the customer, well, okay, wait a minute, you're adding this, this, and this, and that's going to be an extra whatever it is, $200 or something. That's perfectly acceptable, perfectly understandable to the customer. But the problem is you changing terms before the customer does. If the customer changes terms on you, it's okay to respond with a new quote. But it's not okay to change those terms after you've agreed in writing or verbally to a particular quote when the customer made no changes. It's a mistake to not look at a situation as much as possible from the other guy's perspective. As the old saying goes, there's two sides to every story. But most of the time, we're not really required to see the other guy's perspective. You know, it's okay to say to our friends, our wives, whomever, boy, what a jerk that guy is. He did this wrong. And we don't really have to care what the other guy's perception of it was, which probably is very different than yours. However, as small business owners, we do have to look at the situation from the other guy's perspective, because if we don't, let me be very blunt, if you don't do that, you're going to lose a lot of customers and you're going to lose a lot of money. To the customer, the things that are important might be very different than what you think should be important. Let me give you an example that happened to me just last week. I had a dishwasher installed in my house, a new dishwasher installed. I had a portable there before. With the new one coming in, the plumber had to do a lot of new pipes, and a lot of things have to be added. It worked fairly well. One night I noticed a lot of water coming down. What happened is a little plastic pipe that attached to the drain on the sink got dislodged. A simple thing. I mean, I hooked it up myself again. I just put the pipe there, tightened it. It worked fine. I'm sure the way the plumber who installed it looks at it is, well, wait a minute, that's just a small part of what I did. That's really all right. I didn't tighten that, but I did the main work right. To me, I had a mini flood in my kitchen. I was real unhappy. I just paid this guy a lot of money, and I had to go do this work myself, which, again, I know is nothing. It took me a screwdriver and about 5 minutes to do it. But nevertheless, from my perspective as the customer, that guy did a bad job. I don't care if 99% of the job was done right. And the next time I need a plumber, chances are I'm not going to call that guy back. Another example that I hear a lot from customers is the guy came in and he put in my alarm, tracked dirt all over the rug. Or the plumber came in and did this, tracked dirt all over the place. You, as the plumber or the person who put in the alarm, well, wait a minute, but we did a wonderful job. We ran into all these problems installing that alarm, and you're complaining about dirt. Well, to that customer, that dirt in the floor is every bit as important as the job you did on the alarm, and the job is going to be tainted because you did track the dirt. To you, it's a small thing. To you, it has nothing to do with what you were trained to do and what you're being paid to do. To the customer, it's a different story. You have to try as best you can to look at it from the customer's perspective. What's in it for them? What are the important things to them? What are the things that need to be avoided from the customer's perspective, and respond accordingly? Too many entrepreneurs don't take advantage of free help and other free services that are offered to them. The main reason a lot of people choose to go into their own business is that they value their independence. Sometimes, though, people throw out the baby with the bathwater. I don't need anybody's help. I'm going to do this all on my own. Damn the torpedoes, that kind of attitude. When there's some very good sources of help out there, some of them are very cheap. Some of them are even free. And some of them can do a whole lot of good for your business, especially in areas of advice. Now, I said before, and I'm not contradicting it, not to overuse professional advice, but don't underuse it either. Some of the things that I'm talking about, well, the Small Business Administration, they have SCORE, the Service Corps of Retired Executives. It's a lot of retired people are working a few hours a week there. The quality of that varies. They also have something called the Small Business Development Center. This is connected with the SBA. It's not run entirely by the SBA, but there is an SBA connection there. That's run with graduate schools and, in some cases, undergraduate schools, where you have some usually very, very good business students who put in several hours a week toward helping small business owners. They're very good to use if you have a particular problem to solve. I wouldn't advise going in there saying, I'm having problems, what should I do? I'd advise something more along the lines of, I'm having this particular problem with figuring out how to price this service, or this particular problem with getting a business loan, something very specific they could be very helpful with. Other sources of help, the U.S. Department of Commerce, in some cases, provides help. Certain state departments of economic development or of business development, the local chamber of commerce in a lot of situations, in a lot of areas, provides help. The thing to do is to, at the very least, learn what help is available to you, should you ever need it. And if you don't need it, that's fine. But at least when you do need it, know what's out there. And if you do need help, by all means, take advantage of it and get it. Many people go into small business with the vague idea that they're going to someday sell their business. The mistake that I see is that it stays vague. They don't think in terms of, how am I going to plan for selling my business at someday? How am I going to increase my business's value so that I could sell it for a good price someday? Selling a business is hard. Selling a business takes a lot of time, a lot of frustration. But more importantly than the time and frustration that it's going to take at the selling end is that you put the time in at the front end. In other words, take steps to make your business sellable. Now, in the confines of this short tape, I can't go into great detail on the things that are necessary to do to make the business more sellable. But let me say this, it might be well worth your while to hire a consultant who specializes in selling businesses. It might be worth your while to hire a business broker well ahead of the time when you actually plan to sell the business, so you can take the steps that are necessary to increase the value of that business for the day when you do choose to sell it. Because the fact is that the real pot of gold may be at the end. Yeah, while the business is running, you'll take your salary out of it, you'll take your profits out of it, but at the end, when it's time for you to retire to California or Florida or wherever it is you're planning to retire to, it would be nice if you could sell your business and finance that dream. And your chances of doing that are a whole lot better if you plan for it several years before you actually plan to do it. Let's talk for a minute about managing time and resources. It's often said that an entrepreneur's time is his or her most important resource. And, you know, I know this sounds pretty silly in a way or pretty simplistic, but there's a good deal of truth to it. Since time's so important, using it effectively is really important. In fact, I'd go as far as to say that if I had a choice of investing in a business where money is used poorly but time is used well, or a business where time is used poorly but money is used well, I'd rather the business where time is used well. I'd rather put my money, I'd rather bet on that business, because I think, especially in the early stages of a business, time is at least as important, if not more important, than money. You can't manage your time very well if you don't set priorities and goals. Otherwise, you're directionless. Now, I understand that in small business, there's always brush fires to put out. There's an old saying that when you're up to your shoulders in alligators, it's hard to remember that your goal was to drain the swamp. Having said that, it is very important to set priorities for yourself. Otherwise, you're just going to be doing nothing but putting out the brush fires, and you're not going to be able to take a clear direction into the future, into improving your business. What do I mean by that? Well, you might want to set priorities in terms of short-term, medium-term, and long-term. Short-term priorities might be, by the end of the week, I want to get these three quotes out to these customers who I talked to a few days ago. Medium-term, within a couple months, I want to be working on a plan for getting more small corporation customers and get a little less dependent on residential customers. I'm not saying that that's necessarily a good thing. I'm just using it as an example for a direction you may want to go. Long-term goals, well, selling the business someday, becoming a business of X number of hundreds of thousands of dollars a year by doing A, B, C, and D. it's important to set your goals, to set your priorities, and to live by them. Again, you've got to take care of the business at hand. You've got to take care of the needs of the customers. You've got to do the installations. But you can't get so wrapped up in that that you lose sight as to why you set out to be in business yourself in the first place, as to what's going to happen 6 months, a year, 2 years, 5 years down the line. A well-managed business is a business where the person or the people in charge of it have control of the short term as well as have a good picture and a good degree of control over what's going on in the long term. They're constantly holding the reins. They're running the business. They're not letting the business run them. I want to talk briefly about marketing, some of the mistakes that I see in marketing. Really, there's a very basic mistake that I see in marketing, and that's that small business people don't know what it means. When I said marketing, a lot of you thought of, well, what he's going to talk about now is how to sell something to a customer. Selling is only a very small part of marketing. Marketing involves a lot more than that. It involves, in a more general sense, what does the customer want? What about pricing? What about other issues like getting things to the customer? It involves selling. It involves advertising. It involves the whole scope of getting product and services to the customer and getting paid for them. Now, let me talk about what the customer is buying. What the customer is buying and what you're selling, believe it or not, are sometimes two separate things. You might be selling, if you're in the alarm business, you might be selling your services to do the wiring. You might be selling the wiring itself, of course, in the alarms. The customer isn't really buying that. The customer doesn't really care about the wires running through his house, doesn't even really care so much about the alarm. What is the customer buying then? The customer is buying security. The customer is buying the safety that your product and your services are going to provide him with. He's not really buying the wires themselves. What he's buying is the peace of mind that at night he's going to go to bed and his family's going to go to bed, and knowing that if somebody tries to break into his house, there's at least a level of protection from that alarm. I could use another example. If you're installing HVAC, you're selling ducts, you're selling your labor, you're selling the other materials that come with it, of course. The customer isn't really buying that. The customer doesn't really want the ducts. He wants what they're going to provide him with. What is that? He wants the cool house in the summertime. That's what he's buying. He might even be buying the status that comes with it. He might be buying the status that comes with inviting the neighbors over and, hey, look at this. I put in a new air conditioner. Cost me $30,000. Look how cool it is in my house, and your house is all warm and uncomfortable. You know, maybe he's buying that kind of status. Maybe he's buying that kind of satisfaction. It's important for you to have a sense of what your customer is buying. It's important for you to understand that what your customer is buying might be quite different than what you think you're selling. Related to not knowing what your customer is buying versus what you're selling, a related mistake that I see there is not understanding the benefits of your product. I did a little experiment before I came in here today to do this tape. And I actually called up a few plumbers and I said, I'm working on this audio tape here. Just if you wouldn't mind, tell me, why do customers come to you? Why do people come to you instead of to other plumbers? Here's the kind of answers I got. People know that my workmanship is the best. I guarantee for 90 days and I stand behind my guarantee. I've got a fine reputation. Those are the kinds of answers I heard. Then I did something else. Talked to a few of my neighbors, and first question I asked them, you use a plumber in the last year? The ones who said yes, I asked them a couple more questions. I said, well, why did you choose the plumber that you chose? Why did you call this guy instead of, you know, everyone else who's out there doing business? Got very different answers. You know what the most common answer was? I called him because there was a sticker or one of those magnet things on my furnace. Or his name was somewhere in my house. second most common answer. You know, I've used this guy a few times over the past few years and never really had a problem with him. Do you know that he's the best in town? No. Even price. You know, price wasn't the most important thing when I talked to my neighbors. They said, well, we just assume that everybody charges the same. Now, that, of course, is for small jobs. For larger jobs, there might be a lot more price comparison than for installing a dishwasher or something relatively small like that. But nevertheless, my point is this, that so many small business owners, and I'm not singling out plumbers, this goes for HVAC, it goes for restaurants, it goes for book publishers, it goes for just about everybody else who's running a small business. Oftentimes they think they know just why their customers are coming to them instead of others. Oftentimes they are absolutely wrong because they, maybe I should say we, don't understand the benefits of our product, don't understand what the customer is getting from it. Now, I wish I could stand here and tell each of you, well, in your case, the customer wants this, and in your case, the customer wants this. It's really not something for me to tell you because I would just be guessing. It's something for you to try to figure out. Might not be so difficult to figure out. It might be a matter of asking your customer afterwards at the end of the job, gee, why did you choose me? There's 25 other HVAC people in the Yellow Pages. Why did you choose me? Or be so bold as to ask them, would you choose me again next time? Why or why not? And as an aside, given what I said in the case of talking to my neighbors and how one of the most important criteria for making a decision was the fact that they saw the label on their furnace, I think you'd be well advised to go out and get a bunch of those labels if you don't have them already, stick them on the furnace or somewhere else when you finish a job, so when the customer looks there in a month, 6 months, or a year, he's going to call you. Be aware of what your customer is looking for in buying the services that you're offering. It's a mistake to not treat your customer's needs as paramount. Your customer's needs are very important, and you've got to consider them. In most industries, including service contract industries, businesses need their customers more than their customers need them. For this reason, customers and not business owners have to be catered to. You've got to understand that your customers care about their needs more than they care about your needs. And don't get into a situation where you have to apologize to a customer for not getting the product delivered on time, for bad service, for anything else. The customer doesn't want to hear it. You know, he might say, uh-huh, I understand. But the next time, he's going to remember, this was installed late, this didn't work out. And it's very easy for him to call someone else next time. What you want to do is give him every reason to call you next time and no reasons or as few reasons as possible to call your competitors next time. I mean, after all, it's a lot easier to keep a customer than it is to gain a new customer. So make sure you do whatever you can to keep a customer. And to do that, you've got to cater to them. And don't make the mistake of arguing with a customer, even if the customer is clearly wrong. I mean, nobody likes losing an argument, but in the case of business, it's important to keep the customer. Don't win the argument and lose the customer, because then you lose anyway. Statements like, I understand, you have a good point, are a lot better than, but you said this, or, but you didn't say this, and this didn't happen. Forget that kind of stuff. Think in terms of diffusing any kind of argument. Think in terms of keeping that customer. Don't think in terms of winning that argument. You know, there's a saying that some of the most successful businesses I see live by, and that saying is, the customer is always right, even when the customer is wrong. Remember that. The customer is always right, even when the customer is wrong. Okay, let's face it. Human dynamics play an important part of any kind of business. The people who are generally attracted to small business are often very optimistic and like to think in terms of what they can do, not what they can't do. Like to think in terms of things working out, not in terms of problems along the way. Nevertheless, there are problems, and you have to recognize them before you get yourself into deeper trouble. Let's take a quick look at just a couple of them. One misconception that I see all the time is entrepreneurs who get themselves into a little trouble decide, well, I'm not really in trouble. The numbers don't really reflect reality. Let me give you an example. I was at the shop of somebody who was selling windows. And I said, well, how's business? Great. So I decided to be a little bit more direct. Said, well, how are you doing financially? Pointed to a pile of windows and said, I'm putting up this job right here, right now. I made $5,000 on it. What I decided at that point, and I later was proven to be right, is that business was in financial trouble. Why did he point out that one job where he made $5,000? The reason is because on all the other jobs, well, there weren't all that many other jobs, was one of the problems, but the other was that he was losing money on several of the other jobs. The fact is that financial statements, the numbers, are the way that we keep score in business. Now, in the early stages, a lot of businesses lose money, and along the way, occasionally, for an occasional month, even an occasional year, just about every business has downs, hopefully with ups to balance them off, but occasionally just about any business has a period of performance that's not great. But the numbers don't really lie. I've seen too many situations where people see the numbers, they'll visit their accountant or something, and the accountant say, well, you're losing money. They'll discount it and decide that, well, the numbers are wrong, the accountant's wrong, but 99 times out of 100, the numbers aren't wrong, the accountant's not wrong. The entrepreneur is wrong in thinking that the numbers are not telling the story, because almost invariably they are. Another mistake that I see that's very much related to thinking that numbers don't reflect reality is refusal to recognize problems in a general sense, not necessarily financial problems, but all sorts of problems. As a business owner, it's your responsibility to recognize problems as early as you possibly can and to take the practical steps needed to correct those problems. Problems are going to come up all through the course of your business. A lot of people think that, well, there's a lot of problems at the beginning, but after the first 6 months or a year, it's smooth sailing, there aren't any problems. Seldom happens that way. Problems come up all the time, if not on a daily basis, on a weekly basis. The thing to do is to recognize them as early as you can and solve them before they become too big to solve. Now, as I said before, entrepreneurs by nature are optimistic and sometimes overly optimistic. And sometimes what that means is that they won't recognize problems. They just insist on seeing them as non-problems, as things that are going to go away. History is filled with examples of business owners, of business managers, putting on their blinders and pretending problems aren't there when in reality they are. What comes to mind is going back to the 1960s, 1970s, when Japanese cars started coming into this country. The American automobile manufacturers, in retrospect, should have seen a big problem, but they didn't really. They hid behind some of the old thinking of, well, a few of these cars, yeah, but most people, they just don't want little Japanese cars. They want what we're selling. They want the kind of models we have. They don't really care about the advantages of dependability, of fuel economy and whatnot. It's not a threat. In reality, of course, it was very much of a threat. And if the managers then hadn't put their blinders on, then perhaps the Japanese wouldn't have 25, 30, 35% of the American automobile market today. But those managers did put on their blinders. They refused to recognize problems. And a lot of small business owners today do the same thing. Don't be one of them. Deal with problems as early as you possibly can, so they don't become problems that become too big to solve. It's a mistake to assume that in business, the way things are now is the way that they're going to stay. There's a tendency for business owners to get complacent, especially after they've had some success. people tend to think after they've been in business for a year, well, geez, we had a lot of problems starting up and this problem and that problem, but now they're all solved. Now we're going to go forward on a nice, even keel. In reality, it's not going to be that simple. In reality, the situation's going to change. New competitors, for example. Just as you were the new competitor when you started, there's going to be other new competitors that are going to challenge you. It's very likely that when you started, other companies that were already in the business heard about it and said, what's the big deal? They're young, they're inexperienced, they're underfinanced, they're not a threat to us. Don't make the same mistake they did. Don't assume that when you hear about a new competitor that they're no threat to you, because they very well may be. There's also changes in technology. One that comes to mind is alarms. Now, 10, 12 years ago, there were no such thing as alarms that worked on radio frequency. There were no wireless alarm systems. I'm quite sure that there were people then who were making a very nice living wiring alarms in people's homes and in small businesses who made light of the fact that, this new wireless stuff, how can it possibly work? It's not going to be any good. Well, that was a threat then, continues to be a threat now, and I can promise you there's going to be other threats from the technology. My point is this, not to fear them, but not to ignore them either, to constantly watch the horizon, to constantly watch for the changes that may affect your industry, and to deal with those changes. As long as you expect those changes, as long as you're prepared to deal with them, the changes aren't going to be harmful to you.
We hope this edition of the Service Contractors Business Tape of the Month has given you many new ideas to help you run your company more effectively. Along with this month's tape, you also receive several other things. There is a short summary of the tape you just heard, a brief outline of the program for quick review, and you will also find a customer response card enclosed. There is a place on the card for your comments on this tape, as well as space for suggestions you would like to make for topics on future tapes. The response card is postage paid, so please write down a few comments and drop it in the mail. We would love to hear from you. The Service Contractor's Business Tape of the Month is produced and distributed by Grandy & Associates. If we can be of service to you, give us a call on our toll-free line at 1-800-432-7963. Until next month, remember, invest your time and invest your money in those things that will reproduce.